Hello, this is the Online Resilience Podcast with me, Louisa Street, and Professor Andy Phippin. We're discussing all aspects of young people's online lives and giving practical advice on how to support the young people you work with. Music is by Rue Pestock. Welcome to another episode of the Online Resilience Podcast. Today we are talking about changing the narrative around online safety from prohibition to harm reduction. For anyone who isn't sure what that means, harm reduction is an approach that we use to try and reduce harm from things which are inherently often quite harmful. So we use harm reduction every single day. If you get in a car and put your seatbelt on, that is harm reduction. If you look both ways before crossing the road, that is harm reduction. If you teach young people about condoms because you don't want them to catch STIs or have unplanned pregnancies, that is also harm reduction. If you talk to young people about the risks of substance use and how they might reduce those risks, again, that can be harm reduction. So it spans a huge range of things, some of which feel very natural to us and very easy to talk to young people about. And some of them might feel a little bit more on the hard edge of that. A really sort of good example of that within one setting is if we think about substance use. A really good bit of harm reduction to teach young people is if something goes wrong, call for help. A harder bit of harm reduction to teach young people is if you're taking cocaine, this is how long you want to leave between doing lines. That's much harder and that can feel a lot more uncomfortable. When we are thinking about harm reduction within online activities, obviously we're going to have a different kind of scale of what that might look like.
One of the things I find really interesting in this area, having done it a long time, is what young people disclose as concerns, and you know, we've experienced this a lot talking to young people through the Head Start project, are very different to what adults feel they should be concerned about. And I think that's a really important thing to reflect upon. So when you talk to young people about online harms, they'll sort of talk about peer-on-peer abuse, why someone's profile picture's got more likes than theirs, Stress from viewing current affairs. Yeah. And then if you look at what has been referred to as adultist narratives around this area, it's let's stop them looking at pornography, child sexual abuse material, grooming, going down self-harm rabbit holes and all those sorts of things. It is unlikely, it's not unheard of, but it is unlikely that young people bring those things up directly as concerns. One of the reasons why the harm reduction approach makes so much more sense rather than, you know, we need to stop them doing that because good luck with that, is that it makes you ask the question, well, what is the harm we're trying to reduce?
Yeah.
Because a lot of these things are due to adult discomfort as much as they are genuine concern for the safety of the child. You know, the example I frequently give is being called by an alternative provision unit to say there's one of their 16-year-old males was accessing pornography, and they were really concerned. They said, well, there's an awful lot of 16-year-old males accessing pornography. What are you worried about? And they seemed to think that there was a legal challenge there. And so I said, there's no legal challenge there. And they immediately went, oh, thank God for that. We don't have to worry about that. which was really interesting because, you know, the conversation there was, well, what is your concern? Because I'd rather they weren't, but they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, most 16-year-olds who access pornography are not demonstrating problematic sexual behaviours. Some that are, but equally you talk to relate counsellors and that's the same across the adult population as well. And if we're saying we need to stop them doing it, you don't really start to unpick what your concern is or what is the harm. Is there going to be harms coming from a 16-year-old accessing pornography? Potentially. Mm. But the majority aren't harmed by what they see. And I think that's a difficult conversation for us as adults to have, because it's far better if we just go, well, we need to stop them doing that. Now, government narrative on this for the last well over 10 years now has been, we need to stop young people looking at pornography. So the young people they were trying to stop looking at pornography then are now adults with free access to pornography, so that didn't work. And now they're trying to prevent their kids instead. So you know, the prohibitive approaches are generally quite problematic and sometimes formed with the best of intentions for the wrong reasons. Because when you take a pause and go, well, what is the harm in that? Sometimes you struggle.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is a really important part of harm reduction, is that it's more of an ethos than a how-to guide. Like, we can definitely talk through examples of harm reduction, but if you always come at those sort of conversations from a harm reduction approach, then you'll find that you'll probably be having much more detailed and useful conversations with young people, rather than it being that very, I'm telling you that this is what you need to know, this is what you need to do.
I think, it happens too much. It's like, right, don't do that. Why not? Don't ask questions. It's because I said so. Now, the classic one for me is the primary school setting, where they don't talk about social media because they shouldn't be on it because it's illegal. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of unpick that and you go, yeah, but what's the harm? Oh, well, they could be groomed. Well, yes, but they could be groomed at the brownie hut or whatever else. So what would we do in an offline situation? Well, we'd provide routes for disclosure, and we'd provide the means for the young person to be able to talk about this uncomfortable thing that happened, or this person that's been talking to them outside or something. Why aren't we doing that? Why are we rather saying we don't talk about it because they shouldn't be doing it? Because there is inherently no harm in a 11, 12 year old being on social media. It just depends on, in exactly the same way as for 13 and 14 year old, it depends on what they're doing on social media.
Yeah.
And saying, we shouldn't be doing this because, it is the classic narrative of because I say so.
Yeah.
And then, most people seem to think it's for safeguarding reasons. It's not. It's purely for data protection. There's nothing illegal about 11-year-old going on social media. But it fits a prohibitive narrative rather than,
And I think the interesting thing about, if you talk to children who are 10 or 11 about social media, a lot of them will have social media accounts. And when you sort of unpick what is their understanding of the risk of social media and why perhaps they are discouraged from having a social media account, it doesn't, their understanding of that doesn't go very deep. A lot of them will know, like, oh yeah, I know I'm not meant to. And then they'll say, but my mum checks everything that I do. And so there'll be some harm reduction stuff around that. But what there won't be is an understanding of why we might be concerned about them. Yeah. And I was talking to some younger children, young primary school children, and their main sort of understanding of it was, well, you might get kidnapped. And that obviously would be a very rare and very extreme example of what might happen. And obviously, I'm not suggesting that we sit and explain to 7-year-olds what grooming is and all of the horrible things that go alongside that. But it's that sort of, it shows that prohibitive approach has said, if you do this, you could get kidnapped. And as with all prohibition messages, that's not going to work, because they'll see their friends having social media accounts and not getting kidnapped, and they'll be like, well, it's obviously fine then.
Well, again, it's kind of like they'll get the message about don't talk to strangers, or someone might ask if you want to go to their house, or they're saying they're picking you up from school because they've got your mum, and those messages are always delivered to primary age children. But then you go, oh, but what about online? Well, you shouldn't be on it. It's completely contradictory. Because the implication then is, well, if something bad does happen, it's your fault because you shouldn't be on it. Whereas, we talk quite a lot around, providing the tools for mitigating risk, harm reduction or risk mitigation or something. And unless you have those conversations, which, as you say, you don't have to go into the details of grooming, but you can talk about how people you don't know might talk to you and might ask you to do something you're uncomfortable with, and it's all right to say no. You look at the NSPCC Pantosaurus stuff. Yeah. There's some very early discourse around that, but if it suddenly flips to online, all of a sudden that's really bad, and you're projecting anxieties, and you're also projecting blame by saying, well, don't go on it because it's dangerous, without actually explaining. And it's not dangerous. People using it might be dangerous, but Instagram is not dangerous. Yeah. Instagram is a platform for posting photographs.
So, absolutely.
It's important to, like I was saying, take a step back and go, all right, what is the harm?
Yeah. And I suppose it sort of begs the question, is it possible to have a totally risk-free experience of the internet? And I would say probably not. I think, you know, young people will take risks online. Some of those risks will be preventable, and we can definitely encourage them to avoid taking those risks. Some of them, you know, are going to be somewhat unavoidable. We were chatting to some year nine students recently and asking them about seeing upsetting content online, and they said they see it, it comes up on their feed, and they just scroll past it and ignore it. Now we could say, well, that's an unacceptable level of risk for them to be exposed to that sort of material, but that when I say that, you know, is it actually possible to prevent risks online, it's that sort of thing that probably not. You know, if other people their age are engaging with that content, then probably they're going to see it at some point. They just need to know what to do about it and how to respond to it.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, we've run this survey for years, and one of the things that we ask in this survey is, have you ever seen anything upsetting online, or has anything upsetting happened online? The number of times, looking at the dates when the survey was done, they're focused on significant current affairs events. So obviously COVID over the last couple of years, the Manchester bombing before that, the Rigby murder before that. I'm sure with surveys being run at the moment, people will be worried about Ukraine and stuff. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about having zero risk or making a perfect online experience, then we're on a hiding to nothing, unless we are, you know, you could just do it, just tell them it's going online, but then they might see it on the telly. Like, where do you want to go to prevent this stuff from happening? Because it is far less likely that a young person in that survey says something like, I saw some self-harm content or I saw some pornographic content. The things they're disclosing they've seen are generally related to the things that the filters won't pick up. And if you are constantly adopting a prohibitive approach, you know, it's a bit like, I need to know where my child is when they're at school, so I track their device. It's like, okay, but they're at school. It's like, yeah, but I need to monitor their internet access in case someone's mean to them. Okay, yeah, but they're at school.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, I'll tell you what, just live stream their day. You know, stick a GoPro on them, live stream it. You can sit at home, you watch their day. And at that point, normally people go, well, that's ridiculous. Okay, well, you know, most of the concerns we have as adults aren't part of young people's lives. We're chucking a huge amount of prohibitive technology and behavior at them. And it doesn't, you know, young people constantly have said to us over the course of this project, I need someone I can talk to about it. I need someone who can answer my questions. I need someone who will help if something's gone wrong. They will generally, you know, we start sessions by going, what's the worst thing about being online? It's rare they'll say pornography.
Yeah.
Most of them quite like it. You know, when you have serious conversations about pornography, they will talk about unrealistic expectations and younger people accessing it and those sorts of things. But they will also have questions about it. So if you're then telling them, well, you shouldn't be looking at it, end of discussion, then that's, you know, how is that in the interest of the child? How is that aligned to the rights of the child?
Yeah. If we considered what the risks that adults and particularly professionals mainly think about when they think about young people online, I think, you know, there's a few things that we can kind of easily say, these are things that you are probably worried about as a professional, and it will be things like sending nudes. For younger children, it might be talking to strangers. It might be things like buying drugs or weapons online. And I think, you know, if we consider that that's quite rare, and that what young people consider those risks to be is going to be very different, we also just need to remember, before we kind of get stuck into what harm reduction around sending nudes might look like, is we just need to think about, am I taking a harm reduction approach, or am I saying, well, if it upsets you, just stop looking at it, because that isn't going to happen. If a young person is obsessed with TikTok and then they start seeing stuff that's upsetting them on TikTok, it's not, you know, it's using that prohibition message if we say, well, just stop watching TikTok.
Yeah. Or well, it's your own fault for doing it, or you shouldn't be on it, or, you know, all of those sorts of things. Or the classic, someone goes and discloses that there's a nude of them going around the school because they shared it with their partner and their partner shared it further. And the first thing they get in response is, well, you shouldn't have done that, should you?
Yeah.
It's like, well, hey, that's yeah. really good. That's really helpful, isn't it? Or worse, they get told off for being stupid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have laws in this country that protect adults from that sort of thing because it happens to adults a lot as well. You know, it's not just something which is young people doing this. Yes, again, we'd probably rather they didn't, but if it's shared further, then we need to help them. We don't need to be telling them that, oh, well, you can't do anything about that now, that's it. Mm. Telling a 14-year-old their life is over and they'll never get a job. Or, all the classics. So, you know, if you swear on Instagram, you'll not get a job because someone will check out your Instagram profile and things. And yeah, it doesn't help. And, you know, it's interesting reflecting on harm reduction in terms of nudes and things, because young people have developed their own strategies, such as make sure your face isn't in it and those, and make sure there's no sort of recognizable things in the background and stuff, because then they have tried to build their own anonymity into it. But that's against the backdrop of being told, don't do it. If you do it, it's bad.
Yeah. And I mean, when I talk about this, I get really I get, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck standing up, because I think this is such a wonderful thing. But harm reduction around drugs really started because the government took this very prohibitive approach where they said, you know, we're going to stop nightclubs selling water and having chill out zones because that's encouraging people to take ecstasy. And then lots of people started dying from overheating or drinking too much water from taking ecstasy. And so drug users started going to clubs to give people information about how to take ecstasy without dying. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And we can kind of use that approach when talking to young people and listening to what they're saying, like what that almost grassroots kind of approach is, but also kind of thinking a bit about how we might be able to better support them. So yeah, it's great to talk to them about what they might do to reduce the risk of that being shared around without their consent. Obviously not being identifiable in it. Also, if you're sharing it with someone, having agreed rules about, like, you know, if it's sent on Snapchat, that it's not screenshotted. And although young people will say, oh yeah, but you get a notification to say if it has been screenshotted, like, that's all well and good, but they will still have the screenshot of it. But having that thing of, like, agreeing when those will be deleted is good. Not kind of keeping hundreds of photos on a reel of all of the photos that person has sent you, and then splitting up with them and having to convince them to delete all of those hundreds of photos. It's probably easier to have those conversations whilst still with that person.
While on good terms.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, it's also that thing of talking to them about, well, where would you go to get help if they did share it on? Who would you talk to? And reassuring them that, you know, if you're their teacher, if you're their youth worker, social worker, parent, anyone, to say, look, I don't want you to do this, but if you are doing it, and that happens and somebody shares it on without your consent, I promise I will not report you to the police. Can't promise I won't necessarily be upset, but I'll promise that, you know, you won't get in trouble for it. And we'll talk about what to do about it. And I think that really is going to encourage young people to talk to you and is going to give them the understanding that there is somewhere they can go, and that, yeah, whilst we can totally tell them it's illegal, that shouldn't be the end of that conversation.
Mm. I always think with the it's a legal thing, you need to explain it clearly. And you know, it's based on a very old piece of legislation that no one's changed, and as a result of that, we've got a whole bunch of sticking plasters over it. And the public interest test would suggest that unless it's done in a predatory way or in an aggressive way, or something, you know, there's just saying it's illegal isn't enough. The law is actually far more complex than that. And again, it's one of those lazy pieces of discourse that mean, oh, well, I don't have to worry about having a more serious conversation about this because I could just say, well, you shouldn't have done it, it's illegal. But, like, you shouldn't be on social media until you're 13, it's illegal. Those are not harm reduction messages.
Yeah.
And they're of no use whatsoever to the young person who is concerned about something that's happened and wishes to disclose. I mean, it's pretty much a lot of it as a result of conversation with you over the last 2 years. But the way I approach a lot of training with professionals now is to not, when I'm asked, can you come and talk to us about what young people do online? I just go, no, I'm going to come and talk to you about how you can respond to what young people do online instead. Which is, you know, far more important for young people.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I have a huge amount of sympathy for anyone who hears young people talking about what they do online and just thinks, what? Like, what even is that? And why is that interesting or fun? Because it is, you know, it's a different type of world and young people experience it in a very different way to how adults experience it. But yeah, I think it's so easy to get caught up in the detail of it and then forget that actually it's how we respond to it that is going to make the difference to those young people. So we've talked a little bit about sending nudes. There's a couple of other risks that we could kind of think a little bit about how we might respond in a harm reduction or using a harm reduction approach to. The next one that I was thinking was the idea of talking to strangers, particularly I think for younger children. So mm-hmm. where a 15 or 16 year old might be chatting to people in different games and we might not be too worried about that because we'd expect that they would be able to recognize if somebody was asking them for information that they might not be willing to give. Younger children might not be as adept at recognizing that. So how might we use a harm reduction approach in that situation?
I think with all these things, you know, we have offline versions of not talking to strangers and things, and they seem very well established. And then yeah, but what about if it happens online? And everyone loses their minds and it has to become extremely complicated. It's the same sorts of things, you know. It is one of the persistent over the last 20 years myths of the online world, don't talk to strangers. Well, you can't really do multiplayer gaming unless you talk to strangers and things. But if you've got a 7, 8, 9-year-old who wants to interact on Minecraft, then they just go, yeah, this is fine. You know, like see who they're interacting with, you know. Be the parent in those sorts of situations. You know, you don't have to, you know, have enough conversation with parents who, oh, well, I don't want to come across all draconian things. Okay, well, no, you're setting boundaries is perfectly fine. But knowing who they're talking to, but also it might be a group of peers, but one of those group of peers might be saying really grim things to them.
Yeah.
So it's not just necessarily the stranger who is trying to groom them, but providing routes for them to be able to talk about stuff, but also... and we talk about this a lot, looking at the tools available to whatever platform the child is on as well. So you can report people if they are problematic, regardless of age, and you know, encourage them to understand that you don't have to put up with it, and you can mute somebody and you can report somebody and things, and look at what tools are available, not just go, it's either you can't use it or, yeah, do whatever you want with it. You know, there are tools we can use.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think that's really, really useful. And I think also it just kind of, again, promotes that open discussion. And hopefully, you know, if we're engaging with young people who are in the older age range, if they've had professionals in their life who have been kind of able to talk to them about that stuff when they're younger, they're going to be more likely to talk about it as they get older. So, you know, it's about all of us kind of working along the same lines so that all young people know, you know.
I think one of the other things, particularly in primary settings as well, is it should be training for all staff, because the TAs in the classroom have probably got the better, you know, more informal pastoral relationships mm-hmm. with the young people. They're generally not the disciplinarians. So if they haven't received training around these sorts of things, when all they really need to do is like just talk things through with them, I'm not sure what that is, I don't know what that is. That's why it's important that it should be a whole school approach, and it's not just the safeguarding lead and whatever who receive training in this sort of area as well, particularly when it's about adopting harm reduction approaches rather than ban block and panic, you know.
Yeah, and you know, if you are a pastoral lead at a school listening to this and you're thinking, okay, so how, you know, what do I do? There is the training, which people can access through the digital page on the Head Start website, and that is free and it takes a couple of hours. And that would be a really good thing to say to, you know, all of your TAs or all of your pastoral team, or ideally everybody within the school. This is a really good thing for you guys to do and have a kind of understanding of how we can manage risk and respond to risk. So the next thing that I had on my list of risks that young people might face was drugs, buying drugs online. Mm-hmm. And we could kind of extend this to buying anything illegal online. The real disconnect, I think, and there's a brilliant VaultFast report about this. So if you're interested in learning a bit more, if you Google DM for details, you can find the whole report, which basically said, you know, a lot of drugs are sold on social media. And that is a really high risk place because on social media, there are no requirements for reviews to be from real customers. So where a lot of professionals think, oh, young people are going on the dark web to buy drugs. If they are, the reviews that are going to be available in those, you know, from those particular sellers are going to be from genuine customers. Whereas if young people are buying drugs on Snapchat or Instagram, those accounts are shut down within 2 weeks. The people mm-hmm. who run them target young people because they're less able to recognize quality in drug products. So sort of harm reduction around that would be to say, don't buy drugs on social media. you know, and not, you know, I obviously talk to young people about their substance use all the time. I never say to young people, buy your drugs on the dark web instead. It's not about giving them ideas about how to do that. But I think like making sure they're aware that actually buying drugs on social media is really dangerous. It's more likely to be contaminated with really high risk substances because dealers on social media aren't expecting any repeat custom, again, because their accounts are going to be shut down. That dealer that they know that lives down the road that they think might be someone really dodgy actually probably wants to keep them alive, because if they're alive and buying drugs from that person, then they're making money from them.
Yep.
So yeah, maybe having that slightly cynical conversation with young people about drug dealers being business people ultimately, yeah. and they're trying to make money. So yeah, just I think having that awareness that social media is a much more high risk place to buy drugs. And I mean, if a young person is going on to dark markets to buy drugs or any other illegal products, that is a quite high risk place for them to be. So, you know, again, we're not sort of saying go on to dark markets to buy drugs or whatever.
It's better.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, the points you made there are a reaction to the need for a more considered and mature conversation about it, rather than just going, don't go buying drugs. You know, and the implication seems to be, oh, but they're buying it on social media, it's easier to get to, therefore that's the problem. Whereas, you know, as you've said, it's more to do with the quality of products or the harm that might come from that, which is a more mature conversation that needs to be had. But it ties into broader issues of harm reduction in drugs awareness, in that knowing what you're taking and understanding what you're taking and looking at other people might have been talking about the same badge and stuff and those sorts of things as well. You know, the idea that but they buy it on social media now changes any of that narrative.
Yeah.
is you know, kind of amusing. I was talking to a journalist a while ago who was telling me they're writing an article about bad apps, which as you know, really grinds my gears anyway. but she was saying that Telegram's a really bad app for young people. Right. Is it? First of all, I've not come across many young people that use Telegram, but why is it? Oh, because they buy drugs on it. It's like, yeah, but they also buy drugs on Snapchat, Facebook, SMS, WhatsApp. And she went, oh yeah, good point. But it's like there's nothing in Telegram that makes it easier to buy drugs. It's just a way of connecting people to other people and offering products and services.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not about the platform or the technology. It's about the harm reduction associated with drug taking, I think, is an important point to make. And, you know, very valid point you make that, you know, these accounts come and go very, very quickly, and to have a established relationship is actually less harmful.
And I mean, the DM for Details report was really, really fascinating. You know, as I say, I'd highly recommend checking it out if you're interested in knowing a bit more. One of the things that they do say on there is you can't trust reviews on social media, but also if you do look at buying drugs on dark markets, you also need to be aware that reviews that are older than 6 months old probably aren't referencing the drugs that are being sold right now. So, you know, kind of being aware of that and being aware of what the actual risks are. Because young people will have things that they will say, oh, this is a way of reducing the risk. I look at the reviews like, okay, well, let's just talk a little bit about reviews. okay, the only other risk that I had on my list was around hacks, and particularly, you know, people being sent a link from, or, you know, appearing to come from a friend on a different, you know, various social media platforms, saying, oh, I saw you in this video, and you click on it and you have to put in your login information, and then you realize, oh, that isn't a video of me, and now I've given my login information to someone. And the reason I thought this was an interesting one to kind of think about the harm reduction around is just linking that back to that sort of victim blaming thing that quite often happens. As soon as anyone says that they have done that, that they put their information in, the narrative is so often like, oh, why'd you do that? Why didn't you recognize it for what it was? And, you know, this is as likely to happen to young people as it is to older people. I think we have perhaps a perception that older people are more vulnerable to it than younger people. But I think just the harm reduction there is around saying, if you're not sure what to do, come and talk to me and we can work it out together.
And one of the things that, I'm not sure the word is amusing, but you know, if you just go on Facebook for a while and you'll see someone's commented, someone you know has commented on one of those posts that says, what was the name of your favorite pet? And it's kind of like, that's just phishing, you know. so let's not pretend it's just something that happens to young people. It's really interesting the discourse around older people, because, you know, I work from home a lot. Sometimes the TV is on after 9 o'clock. There's a TV show that Angela Rippard and co do after 9 o'clock on the BBC, which is basically, a lot of it is about supporting older people and things, because that's the viewership. And whenever they talk about online fraud there, it's very rare they go, oh, wow, that guy was stupid giving away his bank details. And yet with young people, that's the message that's, you know, you should know about that. Well, why would they know about that?
Yeah.
You know, you don't, unless you're studying computer science, you won't have covered anything related to cybersecurity from like the age of 13 anyway. And, you know, it's variable in quality, but it's one of those things that is, again, one of my, you know, hobby horses at the moment, which is we don't talk about cybersecurity practice as a way to mitigate risk in terms of online safeguarding. So, you know, one of my favorite rants is the, oh, well, you know, we share all our passwords because we love each other. And, you know, it's like, that's not love, that's stalking. And besides, what happens when they split up and you don't know who's got access to your cloud stores and things? But yeah, you know, there's some very simple things, all right? So you've clicked a link, it's gone through, go and change your password, you know, but it requires a certain level of knowledge around those things from the adults they're disclosing to. And also it requires the adult to not start with the default, oh, what did you do that for? Or, oh, well, that's your own silly fault, isn't it? Because people don't say that to older people when they do those sorts of things. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind, is that, again, the digital native narrative, which is really, really irritating. They're not born and suddenly have inherent cybersecurity skills because they happen to have been born in the 21st century. It requires, you know, knowledge and stuff as well, and us to help them understand these risks in the same way that we're helping them understand why talking to strangers is potentially problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if you're a professional and a young person comes to you and says, oh, I've done this, now I'm really worried. If you're not sure what to do, you know, the sort of obvious thing is okay, well, you need to change your password on those accounts. But if you're worried at all about what the other implications of that might be, it should be relatively easy to find on Google. And you know, quite often, if you put in the details of what actually happened, like ask to put in Facebook login to view video, it will probably have information about that specific hack and what it's trying to do. And then you can say, okay, well, you know, you need to delete the app, or you need to update all of your, you know, if you've got a load of things waiting to be updated, they all need to have to download the updates, because that's often a really important part of security. So kind of being aware of that, just look with the young person, Google it, try and find out what to do and how at risk their accounts might be. Obviously, if they've got the same password for every single account on their phone, then,
like many adults do,
yeah, then all of those passwords would need changing as well. But yeah, like that isn't something that you necessarily have to know. That could be something that you look up to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is. It's one of those things where it's important to understand that good cybersecurity practice is a good way of mitigating risk in terms of online behaviours. Yet we don't ever seem to talk about the two things at the same time. You know, no. You have cybersecurity and you have online safeguarding, and never the twain shall meet. You know, yeah. How many staff training sessions on online safeguarding have talked about cybersecurity practices? Whereas, you know, protecting your cloud stores and not sharing everything because you love each other, you know, they are, you know, really important messages to get across.
And I think, and I'm going to try not to get on my soapbox here, because I'm conscious of time. We, you know, if we're tracking every single thing a young person is doing, we are not teaching them about keeping their data secure. Because if it's like, oh yeah, well, my mum, you know, can see absolutely everything I do on my phone, they're not necessarily then going to be that worried if somebody else also can. And actually, you know, we need to kind of be making sure that if you are tracking what your young person is doing, that they understand why and kind of how long that will be happening for and up until what age, and that could potentially be negotiable. And, you know, in the same way as any rules within a household are going to be somewhat negotiable, and they might have freedoms that might be taken away if they get in trouble. All of that should still apply online. We shouldn't just be kind of watching every single message they send, because
you're basically instilling poor privacy practices, you know, because yeah. If you expect it to happen, it's one of the interesting things I talk about a lot is that, okay, well, tracking as a child is viewed as okay, however, tracking an adult can be used as corroborating evidence of a harsher sentence in a domestic abuse case. You know, let's reflect on this. And one of the wonderful conversations around privacy I have frequently with young people is, oh, does privacy concern you? No. Why is anyone interested in what I've got? And you go, can I have a look at your phone then? And they go, no. Go, why not? Because it's private. It's like, oh, it's just that no one's ever had that conversation with you, isn't it? So no, absolutely. If we instill the values that privacy isn't important, or worse, you do not deserve privacy. Mm. You know, I always go back to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which we ratified in 1989, which specifically says that young people do have a right to privacy.
Yeah.
Yet there are lots of people in the safeguarding arena that would argue that no, they don't, because we need to keep them safe, which is just appalling.
Yes. Well, okay, so to avoid getting too soapboxy, we'll sort of bring it back to harm reduction just to kind of wrap up on this one. So hopefully this has given you a bit of an idea of what a harm reduction approach might look like. Andy, I don't know if you've got any other nuggets or suggestions that will help people keep that harm reduction.
I think it's, you know, posing the question, you know, what is the harm? Am I concerned about this because I'm genuinely worried about the young person? Am I concerned about this because I wouldn't have done that when I was their age, therefore it must be bad? You know, having something that contradicts your value system is not the same as genuine concern for a young person. But also, a lot of this stuff is fairly straightforward. Take a step away from the technology and, all right, how do we mitigate these risks? A lot of the time it is about providing routes for disclosure and being able to answer those questions So, you know, as well as roots of disclosure, having an environment where young people can ask questions and get answers is a really important foundation for adopting a harm reduction approach, because then they are confident they can ask about things rather than delivering those assemblies around don't do this, don't do that, and don't do that. And if you do, you are bad. Because that doesn't help anybody.
Absolutely. And I guess I would just add to that, you don't need to know it all off the top of your head. You can sit with a young person and look that information up. To kind of wrap that up, I guess it's an interesting reflection that I was doing a session last week, and I was asked a question which I should know the answer to, and I didn't, and I had to stand there at the front of the class looking it up on my phone whilst I checked the information. And you know, there's a part of me that wants to say, like, oh, I should have known that, I don't know why I didn't just have that information available in my brain. But you won't always. And you know, if you're an English teacher, then you're not necessarily going to know what to do if a young person starts talking to you about risks that they might be taking online. But yeah, don't be afraid to check, rather than perhaps relying on a prohibitive message which is going to shut down any further discussion.
Or don't ask questions. Wonderful approaches. Yeah. But no, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Or turning it back with the young person, go, well, what do you think? Or what advice would you give a friend or something? You know, you don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to be the peer at the font of knowledge at the front of the room.
Yeah.
You learn more from conversations than you do from telling.
Definitely. Yeah, and if you're with a whole class in a situation like that, then yeah, it might be that someone else in the class has got that information. Yeah. So we will wrap it up there. Look out for another podcast coming soon. That's it for another episode of the Online Resilience Podcast. If you liked it, please tell someone you know who might also enjoy it. You can share on Facebook, Twitter, or even just pop a link in an email.